Quora tells you how many people have viewed your answer and how many upvotes you received. Thus, you can determine your reach and see what people think of your ideas. Only a small minority of those who view an answer upvoted. As of July 2017, as I write this, and 5 years after I addressed What Makes Life More Meaningful, my answer to that question has received a relatively small audience, 14,000 views and 133 upvotes, while my response to the question about aging has been viewed by 7,200 people and received 36 upvotes. Not exactly home runs. However, it's to be expected. On such sites, most answers receive very little attention, while a tiny minority become disproportionately popular. Soon after, I answered another question. What are the most valuable things everyone should know? I wrote a list of rules or maxims, some dead serious, some tongue-in-cheek. Be grateful in spite of your suffering. Do not do things that you hate. Do not hide things in the fog, and so on. The Quora readers appeared pleased with this list. They commented on and shared it. They said such things as, I'm definitely printing this list out and keeping it as a reference. Simply phenomenal. And you win, Quora. We can just close the site now. Students at the University of Toronto, where I teach, came up to me and told me how much they liked it. To date, my answer to what are the most valuable things has been viewed by 120,000 people and been upvoted 2,300 times. Only a few hundred of the roughly 600,000 questions on Quora have cracked the 2,000 upvote barrier. My procrastination-induced musings hit a nerve. I had written a 99.9 percentile answer. It was not obvious to me when I wrote the list of rules for living that it was going to perform so well. I'd put a fair bit of care into all the 60 or so answers I submitted in the few months surrounding that post. Nonetheless, Quora provides market research at its finest. The respondents are anonymous. They're disinterested, in the best sense. Their opinions are spontaneous and unbiased. So, I paid attention to the results and thought about the reasons for that answer's disproportionate success. Perhaps I struck the right balance between the familiar and the unfamiliar while formulating the rules. Perhaps people were drawn to the structure that such rules imply. Perhaps people just like lists. A few months earlier, in March of 2012, I had received an email from a literary agent. She had heard me speak on CBC Radio during a show entitled Just Say No to Happiness, where I had criticized the idea that happiness was the proper goal for life. Over the previous decades, I had read more than my share of dark books about the 20th century, focusing particularly on Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great documenter of the slave labor camp horrors of the latter, once wrote that the pitiful ideology holding that human beings are created for happiness was an ideology done in by the first blow of the work assigner's cudgel. In a crisis, the inevitable suffering that life entails can rapidly make a mockery of the idea that happiness is the proper pursuit of the individual. On the radio show, I suggested instead that a deeper meaning was required. I noted that the nature of such meaning was constantly represented in the great stories of the past, and that it had more to do with developing character in the face of suffering than with happiness. This is part of the long history of the present work. From 1985 until 1999, I worked for about 3 hours a day on the only other book I have ever published, Maps of Meaning, The Architecture of Belief. During that time, and in the years since, I also taught a course on the material in that book, first at Harvard and now at the University of Toronto. In 2013, observing the rise of YouTube, and because of the popularity of some work I had done with TVO, a Canadian public TV station, I decided to film my university and public lectures and place them online. They attracted an increasingly large audience, more than 1 million views by April 2016. The number of views has risen very dramatically since then, up to 18 million as I write this, but that is in part because I became embroiled in a political controversy that drew an inordinate amount of attention. That's another story. Maybe even another book. I proposed in Maps of Meaning that the great myths and religious stories of the past, particularly those derived from an earlier oral tradition, were moral in their intent, rather than descriptive,